The topic I have today is As Arrows in the Hand. So back in June, I think it was, Elmer contacted me about having a topic here, and I thought about it a little bit. Sure, I can do that. It's still quite a bit of time to prepare, you know. And then after I said I'd do it, he replied right back, I need the title by tomorrow morning. So I had to do some quick thinking, and this, out of Psalm 27, there's a verse about arrows, and that's what came to my mind. So I gave him the title, and then it's getting closer time. I decided I should probably start preparing, and it went a little different than I thought it would. I kind of had in mind what I was going to do, and as I started to study, the Lord laid something a little different on my heart than what I had intended to talk about. So for just to start off with, I'm going to read Psalms 127. There's five verses there. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early and to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he giveth his beloved sleep. Lo, children are a heritage of the Lord. The fruit of his womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. Happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies at the gate. I think we probably have all heard that before, and you know, often it's a joke, you know, we have eight children, so people always ask, well, how big is your quiver? Is it full yet? You know, it's kind of a joke, but there's so much truth in that one chapter in Psalms 127. And I guess part of the reason that I'm a little more intimidated to talk about this is because our homes, our children, it's a very personal thing. It's something each of us does differently. It depends on our upbringing, our personalities. There's so many things we do differently in our homes and raising our children that I don't feel qualified to tell you how to raise your children. I don't think any of us really like when other people tell us how to raise our children, right? And say, my children are still young, and I can say this right now, I'm still in my 30s for another 15 hours. So this will be the last talk ever given my 30. So maybe once I turn 40, I'll be a little wiser. Maybe I should have waited till tomorrow. Anyway, So when I was looking at this, what really came to me, there's three aspects in this concept of arrows. There's the arrows, there's the bow, and there's an archer, right? There's three aspects that make the whole thing work. So the first one I want to look at is arrows. And what I'm using as an illustration is the English longbow. This didn't necessarily come from the Bible times, but I kind of looked a little bit. I read a book about this, and the English longbow, which was during the 14 and 1500s, was probably the height of the strength of the bow. You know, the bow was used, I don't know, probably in Adam and Eve's time. I don't know when they first made the bow, but the English longbow in the 14 and 1500s was like the peak of its power. Before they had firearms, you know, and this was about as high as the strength of the bow got. They were used in the Hundred Year Wars when they're most famous between the English and the French. So I want to look a little bit at the role that the archer, the bow, and the arrow each have, and how that all works together. So in verse 4, it says, as arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. So as God's, or David here is equating arrows with children. All right, so, and if you look at in the time of war, arrows are the part of this combination that actually goes out and does something, right? The archer and the bow stay here, the arrow goes out, and it says in verse 5, speaks to the enemy at the gate. It goes out and reaches out to the enemy. So the arrows are our children. So what is our role with the arrows? I'm gonna look a little bit like the arrows were back in the time of the English longbow. So the arrows were the part that reaches out, and it's the accumulation of the archer and the bow is the accumulation that is the flight of the arrow, right? So the arrow reaches out, and each arrow was individually crafted, made to serve a purpose. There are several different kinds of arrows. There was broadhead or bearded arrows, as they would call them, which is similar to what we think about for deer hunting. Had the sharp edges out. They were used for hunting, or if it was in battle, to kill people that weren't armored. They would cut in and do a lot of damage. They used them to shoot horses, like at a cavalry charge, archers would use broadheads to shoot the horses, to kill the horses, injure the horses. Inflicted a lot of damage very quickly, no matter where they hit. But they were very ineffective against armor. There was just not enough force to pierce through armor. So there was also what they called bodkin arrows, which were just very sharp needle knife, like a needle on the end, with heavy needles on the end of the arrows, which were made to pierce armor, which with the development of the Bodkin arrow, it really changed battle. Even armored soldiers were no longer safe. You could take a poor bowman with no armor on, standing 200 yards from an enemy knight with valuable armor and all kinds of jewels, and this poor archer could kill the enemy before he could even anywhere think about doing anything to the archer. Very effective in battle. And then also they had arrows, they would put something on the end of it, light it on fire. You could burn down buildings. Archers could stand far away and launch fire into cities and burn buildings. Obviously, those arrows were pretty ineffective against anything else except buildings, right? So each of these arrows had a different purpose, and they were designed for that purpose. So the archer's job was to take the arrow and do what is intended to do. And that's kind of what I want to look at us as parents. Our children were made by a creator. We didn't make our children. God made our children. He gave us the opportunity and responsibility to care for them. In the same way the archers didn't make their arrows. They were given to them to be used. The arrows were created with a certain purpose in mind in the same way as our children. It says our children are created in the image of God, in his likeness is what our children are created. We know our children. But God made our children. He knows them. He knows our children even better than we do. And he knows the purpose he has for their life. The arrows are all the arrows are designed to be strong, straight, and true. You know, they put goose feathers in the back, you know, for flighting to keep them from going straight. And as I was just thinking about how arrows relate to our children. God gave us our children for us to care for, to protect, in the same way archers protected their arrows, because that was what they took into battle. They wouldn't just throw them in the corner and whatever happened, and just grab them when it's time to go. They kept them in a waterproof case. They kept them somewhere that were bundled up tight. They would be straight and true. When they're ready to use, they were ready to go. So our job as a parent is not to determine the purpose of our children. God has designed them with a purpose. It's not to give them purpose. God has given them purpose. Our job is to help them find that purpose and help them walk in the way that God has designed for them. In the same way archers protected their arrows, we need to do that with our children. There's a lot that goes into that. You know, this is where I'm not going to get into a lot of things on do this, don't do that, do this, don't do that, because I think in each of our families is different. We have our ways of doing this, but we need to protect what God has given us so they can be useful to serve a purpose. A crooked arrow is not very effective. An arrow that the flighting came off is not very effective. An arrow that supposed to pierce armor that the tip's dull, it's not very effective. If your arrows get damp and warped, it doesn't work. Archers need to protect their arrows. We need to protect our children. And we need to help them see the purpose they're created for. That is our job as parents. It's not to give them purpose. God has given them purpose. Our job is to point them in a way that they can find that purpose on their own. I read somewhere that our job as parents should be to work ourselves out of a job. And I think that's what we need to do. You know, for most of our life, we make decisions for our children for just a small part of their life that we help them. For most of their life, they're adults, have their own children. So our job, our obligation, our responsibility as parents is to get them pointed in the right direction, still looking at this thing of arrows, and have them leave the quiver in good condition, you know, that they can do that purpose that God created them for. We cannot improve on what God has designed our people for, but we can destroy that to a certain extent. We can get things pointed in the wrong direction. That's something I see so much in prison ministry. My heart goes out. Each one of those men, I feel strongly God has designed them with a purpose, and sitting there in Indiana State Prison listening to me talk to them is not that purpose that God designed them for. That is a warped thing, that their arrow not being cared for, and I'll go get in the bow and the archer part later. It was warped from what God designed because of poor decisions, ungodliness, generational sins, so many things that play into that. But yet God can, in the miracle that doesn't work with arrows, but it works with people, God can straighten that back out again. But woe unto us as parents if we're the one who causes that problem. God has given us the most awesome responsibility. The greatest creation God made was man. He made it on the sixth day. He said he made the entire universe, heaven, earth, all the animals, the waters, the moon, the stars. But it wasn't complete till he made people. And he gives us, as mere people, the responsibility to raise more people. It's his greatest creation, and it's our responsibility. It's an awesome responsibility. It says in Psalm 127, it says it's his reward. It's his heritage. It's his reward. We see children, so often children are seen as a burden, there's another one, you know, it's what's it going to cost? But it says there in Psalms, it's the heritage of the Lord. It's our inheritance from God. It's the reward we get from the Lord. So in the same, in Psalms 1, in Proverbs 22:6, it says, train up the child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart from it. So the training that I see in this illustration of the arrows is we train our children to listen to God and be obedient to his will. We train our children to find the purpose God has in their life. We don't train them to be what we want them to be. We train them to be what God wants them to be. We're simply caretakers and given the most awesome responsibility that God gave to anybody was to be caretakers of his greatest part of his creation. In the same way that the arrows are the part of this battle that leave the archer and the bow to speak to the enemy at the gate, our children are the part that leave our homes and go reach places that we're not going to be able to reach on our own. There's so much potential in our children. I see all these young people sitting here today, and if each one of these could be shot out as a straight and true arrow and reach the mark that God intended for them, what a kingdom difference that could make in the world. We're spread out, and there's just so much potential here in that. So the next aspect of this I want to look at a little bit is the bow. So we have the arrow, and then the bow. So the bows were made out of, they took a trunk of a tree and cut out a D-shaped piece of wood. They were approximately 6 feet long, and they were cut in the winter out of the trunks of hardwood trees, and yew wood was the most popular kind, Y-E-W, was the most popular kind they used for these bows. So as most of you, anybody who works with wood knows, on a hardwood tree that's growing, there's two types of wood if you cut in the tree. There's the inside part, which is the heartwood, and then the outside where the tree is most recently grown is called the sapwood. So the bows were made right where these two, a slice was cut out where the sapwood and the heartwood comes together. That's how they made the bows. The heartwood is the older wood, stronger. It's the part of the tree that gives the bow the strength. The sapwood is the newer wood that's flexible. It gives the bow its flexibility. Too much sapwood in your bow, it would just be flexible and it would never snap back the way it would, you know, to launch an arrow. Too much heartwood, you can't pull it back, or if you do pull it back, it'll break. There's no flexibility there. So the experts that made these bows, they could study the tree, they could study the log they had, and they could determine how much sapwood, how much heartwood it's going to take to make that bow be effective. And I think we can kind of see how this can relate in our homes. So the bow I want to look at as an example is the things that propel the arrow forward. I look at it as being our homes, the circumstances around them, the pressures they get from the outside, the school, like all the things that we build around our children as they grow up that will spring forth and launch that arrow out. We somehow need to find the right mixture of strength and flexibility. There's so much that we do in our homes to build for that heartwood part of it. You know, we have family devotions. We homeschool our children, send them to church schools for the most part. We come to Penn Valley Family Week. There's so many things that we do in our homes to build structure. You know, we have family worship. And almost in pretty much all of our homes, there's a mother and father is there. Most of our cases, the grandparents are supportive. You know, there's so many. These are all things that are building structure and stability. And you absolutely have to have that But these things are all what I would consider to be the heartwood of the boat. You know, the strength, the stability. And I think so often where we, especially in our plain communities, fail is the flexibility part, the sapwood part of that. And again, I don't necessarily have an answer how that looks in each one of our homes, in each one of our lives. But somehow we need to understand that the purpose and desire we have for our children need to come after the purpose and desire that God has for his children. And that's hard. Especially, I see it so often, you know, whether it's in businesses or whatever, you know, I expect my son to grow up and take over this business and do this and do that and do that. And there's a lot of, that might be fine, that's a lot of good and strength and structure in that. But that might not be what God has. And that's hard. And again, this is an area that I don't even really know how to talk about what builds that flexibility. I'm sure there's people here who probably have better insight on that than what I do, on how to build that flexibility and allow God to be able to use his children in ways that we don't necessarily understand. Because we see so much of that in the world where it's all flexibility. There's no structure, there's no strength, there's no heartwood, and we push back against that. And sometimes we dig in a little too deep on the other side of that. And we end up with a bow that's not flexible, that has no snapback, it has no way to launch an arrow. We have so much potential in our homes, in our communities. There's so many good things that we can build on. Things I mentioned earlier, the churches we have, the homes, the heritage we have, the Bible knowledge and teaching we have. And it says in the Word, to whom much is given, much is required. There is much required of us. And we need to, and our children, there's much required of us, and there's much potential. We can change the world for the Lord if we're willing sometimes to let go. What good would it do if an archer would refuse to let go of his arrow? Just hold on to it, because I've kept good care of this arrow. I'm keeping it here in my quiver. There's no way I'm going to send that out. What if it hit a tree and bent? It'd be pretty ineffective. An arrow doesn't do very well against a sword if they're standing right across from each other. So at some point, the role I want to look at in this is our role as parents is to be able to turn our children over to the Lord. Not that they're not our responsibility, not that we should just let things happen. We need to maintain the integrity of the arrow that God has given us. We need to create a bow that has power. It has strength. It has flexibility. It can work. And there's a lot of things that go into this bow that are things we have nothing to do about. We can't help it where we were born. We can't help it. You know, there's the heritage we've had. We've been blessed. There's a lot of things that, and there's many, many people who don't have that. And again, I think back in the people I talked to in prison. There are crooked arrows. There's barely even a bow there. You know, the bow is like a limp noodle. You know, there was no structure, and yet God can still use that, but it's a terrible disadvantage. I trust that not one of these young people here is going to spend any time sitting on the benches in prison, spending time for crimes they've committed. And I wouldn't expect that. Why wouldn't I expect that? Because, you know, this group of people in the United States, you know, the odds would be somebody's going to choose that path. But there's enough structure, there's enough strength there that we don't need to go that way. We don't have to. I don't expect anybody to take that path. And yet most of these people that are in prison, the way they were brought up, there's about an 80% chance that's where they're going to end up. And that's sad. And yet God can redeem that, and he can use that. But there's scars, there's hurt, I heard somebody yesterday, they were talking about the trauma people go through and the way to heal from that. And all those things that we have the opportunity to not have to go through. So we absolutely have a step up. But yet we have to realize it for what it is. And that is a gift from God. And he's asking a little more of us, I think. And so often, those men in prison, they learn and they grow, and it's an awesome thing to watch. And they can continue to grow and be more effective than I am if the Lord leads them in that way and they continue in that. But yet, we have this opportunity that God has given us. Can we be flexible enough to allow God's plans to take precedence of our plans? Let's take advantage of the benefits we've been given. Let's use every advantage that we can, because Satan uses every advantage he can. We've been given a lot of advantage in the battle. Gary Miller has a book called Church Matters, where he brings up the same kind of concept of this heartwood and sapwood, only he uses the body as an example with bone and muscle. You know, the bone creates structure and the muscle gives strength. It's kind of the same. It's the same concept. Without bones, muscle would just be laying on the ground twitching. And without muscle, the bones would just be a dry skeleton like you see at the doctor's office on the wall. It takes both, and they work against it. The bones don't want to move, and the muscles don't want to hold still. And he uses an illustration in churches, to the stability part and the outreach part, but in our families, it works the same way. The heartwood and the sapwood, they work against each other. When you pull a bow back, the sapwood likes to bend. The heartwood wants to go straight, and that's what makes it work. And I think so often in our homes, we don't find that balance very well sometimes. We see one thing, we see this church is so strict and rigid and there's nothing there, so I'm just going to go completely the other way and go all to the sapwood. Or I've seen how that does and their children are this way, then I'm going to build so much structure in there that'll never happen to mine. And I think in the same way there's a path to make a good bow, there's also a path to make a good family. And I'm just going to leave that at that. Just something for you guys to think about. Because there's pressures so much from the world and Satan that want to destroy the power of this web. He doesn't care if he makes it too rigid or too flexible, as long as he makes so it doesn't work. That's all Satan cares about. He doesn't care how he does that. He doesn't care if it's destroying the arrow, if it's making your bow ineffective. It doesn't matter how Satan destroys it, but that's what he's after. And in all of our homes, there's going to be some flaws in the way we do things. None of us are perfect. I can definitely see that as my children grow older. You can see spots in where we've messed up, and where weak areas in my life. And I think we can all probably see that. But you know what? We have our God is a redeemer. He redeems our mistakes. His grace covers that. But the focus I want to leave on this area of the bow is that let's use the benefits that God has given. Let's use, because there's so many people who don't have what we have. So many people. For probably three-fourths of their life, our children are going to be adults and responsible for making their own decisions. So we just need to remember that as we train them up. We're not training them to do what we want them to do. We're training them to make their own decision and do what God wants them to do. That's the most important part in training our child. So right now, I'm just going to talk a little bit about one battle that took place in this 100-year war. It's called the Battle of Agincourt. It took place on October 25th in 1415. So this war was going on, this 100-year war. England claimed they had the right of the crown over France. France was an independent country. So the English king they were trying to fight. Then he decided they're going to cross the English Channel with a large fleet. I think they said around 1,500 ships. Cross the English Channel, they were going to invade France to rightfully claim his crown. So they crossed the English Channel, laid siege to a town called Harfleur. And they figured they had this large army. This was a fairly small town. They're going to take this town over and keep right on moving. Well, this town was a little more resistant than what the English were thinking. They had big, thick walls, lots of men on the inside. So as they destroyed parts of the walls, the men would rebuild them. And it turned out to be quite a disaster. And then the British got sick with dysentery or diarrhea real bad. And many, many men died. And it was just a terrible, terrible, and it was muddy and it was nasty and ended up being a terrible thing. And finally, after more than a month, the city finally surrendered. And it ended up being because they started shooting fire arrows with fire on it, started burning the town down. They were trying to avoid that because he was coming in as a liberator. I see it kind of the same way as Putin coming into Ukraine. I'm coming as a liberator, but then let's destroy everything. But the English were trying to avoid that. But finally, it took so long, they ended up shooting fire arrows into this city. And most of the city burned down, and English did win, but it came at a terrible cost. And it was September 22nd when the city finally surrendered. It was getting close to winter. It's time to go back home again, right? You don't fight wars during the winter. But the King Henry decided he was going to look like a fool if he came all these men across the English Channel and they just took this one city. So he marched on into France against all the advice that his advisors gave him and said, we're just going to prove that we belong here. Well, the French army, during this whole month that the English were laying siege, the French army was building strength. They were gathering people from around. All the lords were bringing their soldiers, gathering together against this English army. So as the English army marched out, the French army was waiting for them. They shadowed them across the river and led them into a trap where they were forced to fight. So the English army at this point was about 1,500, what they were called men-at-arms or knights, armored men with swords and shields and about 7,000 bowmen. So that's the English army that marched on from Harfleur. And the French army had about 10,000 men-at-arms, or knights and soldiers, and about 15,000 other soldiers. So it came to a battle, which would have been about 8,500 people against roughly 25,000. And in these battles, the people that brought victory were the knights and the men-at-arms, which that was 10,000 against 1,500. So the English were really trapped in this situation. It was a terrible situation for them. There was the way the battle was set up. The English were here camped, and the French were kind of on a ridge, and they were just looking at them. And the French army just kept getting bigger and bigger as more of these people came. The English were wishing they could just run, and it was going to be a terrible day the next day when this battle started. So the French attacked came later in the day. The French attack came, which would have been on a. So it gave the date earlier, October 25th of 1415. And they had these huge lines of men-at-arms or knights marching down towards the English on horseback and marching. Just an overwhelming mass of men. I think the first wave of the French was approximately 5,000 people, if I remember right. So about half of their men-at-arms coming against 1,500. With the archers, English archers kind of on the outsides of it because they were unarmored, didn't have swords. Couldn't fight that way, but the ground was muddy. It had rained. It was a plowed field they were marching across. So as these soldiers marched across, the English longbowmen started shooting, and they started shooting at 300 yards already. And if you can imagine how long it takes a heavily armored knight with a shield and a sword and boots and armor to march 300 yards through knee-deep mud, and each one of these 7,000 archers was trained and had the ability to shoot an arrow about every 3 seconds. So that's 21,000 arrows every 3 seconds that were able to be launched. So as you imagine, and many of these knights were on horses. So as these horses got hit, the horses would go crazy. They would thrash, and it turned into just a terrible quagmire for the French knights. They couldn't get anywhere. They were trampling on each other. Their horses were running people down. The soldiers, but finally their front line did reach the English men-at-arms who hadn't moved. They were standing right where they were, so they were ready to fight. And these French men were coming after being shot at arrows. They had to have their helmet visors down. They couldn't see where they were going. They would trip and fall, and the people behind them were getting pushed by the people behind them. They would get suffocated in their armor. And these were the wealthy French lords. They were being absolutely killed before they even got to their front lines to where they could fight. Most of these men never even got to fight. And it turns out it was a slaughter, and it was an enormous victory for the English. They did so well that they captured so many of the French soldiers that they soon realized they were outnumbered by the people they were holding captive. So they turned around and ended up killing all their captives yet, because they were afraid the captives were going to find weapons and realize they outnumbered the people that took them. So at the end of the battle, approximately 6,000 French soldiers were killed. And the numbers vary on the English fatalities, anywhere from 150 to 600. Just a totally, totally decimated the French army. And if you read through history, like the names of all the French lords that were killed in that, it was just phenomenal, the slaughter that was done to the French in that army. So in that case, the arrow really could speak to the enemies at the gate. The only way the English won that war was by the longbowmen. So the question comes, why didn't the French use the longbow? You can make these arrows fairly easily and cheaply. A good craftsman can make a bow in about 10 days. No, 10, I said, sorry, 10 hours. You can make a bow in about a day. They would cure for a while, but it was not expensive. These knights cost, were raiding way more money. And the French, they tried to use a crossbow, which was also deadly and effective, but they were very expensive, cost about 10 times as much to make. You could shoot once about every 30 seconds to a minute, depending how good you were with it, because you had to crank it, you know. Those of you crossbows kind of know how that works. Very expensive and time-consuming. But there was one reason that the French didn't use longbowmen. I mean, you can make a bow in a day, you can make many arrows in a day, but it takes a lifetime to make an archer. So why is that? So what gave these bows their value? Why did it take so long to make an archer? So who in here does bow hunting? Because there's quite a few. So what's your draw weight on your compound bows? Just 60? Is that 60 to 70 pounds, right? Okay, these English longbows, they actually found some that are historically accurate, and they had a draw weight from between 130 to 150 pounds, and it was not a compound bow. There was no let off on that. So most normal people couldn't pull that bow back more than about this far. It doesn't work very well that way. So these archers, they didn't just, you know, go to school all these years, graduate, and decide, I'm going to be an archer and go buy a bow and an archer. To develop archers, it took at least 10 years before someone could effectively use one of these bows. This is just a little blurb. I'll just read here what I read online a little bit about what it said about how they worked. It says, the medieval English knew that archers didn't grow overnight, so they trained their young boys to be toxophiles, or lovers of the bow, and put little bows in their hands just as soon as they could hold them. The English kings even mandated archery by law to guarantee a supply of lethal archers. Thus, Henry VIII, alarmed by the decline of archery in the 16th century, decreed, all men under the age of 60 years shall have bows and arrows for shooting. Men, children between 7 and 17 shall have a bow and two shafts, and men about 17 years of age shall keep a bow and four arrows. So there was laws that children had to learn to shoot a bow. So the bow could be made in a day, you can make a lot of arrows, but you can't make an archer. And so as we look at how that relates to this bow and the arrow and how it relates in our life, it takes years and years to develop what it takes to effectively use the bow. And so as I thought about you know, this topic, the first thing I said, well, what are some good verses about raising children? So I just want to open it up right now. So, New Testament verses. How many verses can you guys think of about gives us instructions on raising children? Anybody? Just a New Testament verse. There's several you'll probably pop in your head. Yep, that's in there several places, like Colossians 3:21. It says that, and also in Ephesians 6:4. So that's the one we mostly think of. Any others? I have a couple written down here. In Hebrews 12, it says, have you forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children? My son, despise not the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For the Lord loveth he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son he receiveth. If ye endure chastening, God dealeth with you as sons. For what son is he whom his father chasteneth not? And in 1 Timothy 5:8, if any provide not for his own, especially those of his own house, he hath denied the faith, and is worse than an infidel. Then there's one that's often used talking about children, 3 John verse 4, I have no greater joy than to hear my children walk in the truth. But that's John talking to the church. He's not actually talking about children. Then in Matthew, Jesus says, suffer the little children to come unto me. But that's pretty much all the verses in the New Testament about how to raise children, right? Not much there, considering this is the greatest responsibility God has given us. It's his greatest part of creation, and that's about all it says about it. So that's why I'm a little hesitant to tell you to try to give any advice on how to raise children, because it would just be my opinion. So I think in studying this, the greatest verse that we can find to raise children is in 1 Corinthians 11:1. Be ye followers of me, even as I am also of Christ. You can have the best bow and the best arrow without an archer, it's worthless. the most important thing that we can provide our children is to be a man of God. If you go back into Psalms 127, one word that gets overlooked a little bit, as arrows are in the hand of a what? Mighty man. It doesn't just say man, it says mighty man. So are the children of his youth. So the greatest thing we can do in this battle against Satan for the souls of our children is to be a mighty man and woman of God. There's so many different ways that we can raise our children, so many different approaches. You can read books on it, but those are opinions. The truth is we cannot be effective if we are not who God designed us to be. We're going to have flaws, but we, in the same way that archers spent years and years developing the muscle it takes, they said you could pick out, like if you walked into a town, you could pick out who were the archers in that town because their shoulders were twice as wide as the other guys, their chests were thick, their arms were huge. And that was why these weapons worked. If there was a battle and the French would capture English archers, the first thing they would do is chop off the three fingers in the middle of their hand so they could never shoot a bow again. They didn't care about the bows. You can in this case, you could remake the bows. You can make more arrows, but they can't just replace the archers. And in the same way, Satan can reach in through other people and corrupt. Sometimes can corrupt that arrow and corrupt the bow in ways we may not even see it, or ways we may not even have ever thought of. But if we have the power of an archer, God can still use it. See it as fathers especially, because God talks much about fathers as leaders in the home. We provide protection for our families from Satan. And it talks about in Ephesians, I'm not going to read it. I think we all know about the armor of God in Ephesians 6. And I just picture this as a father covering, protecting my children. If there's parts of armor I'm missing, it allows Satan's darts to come right through there. And I think that's the concept that we need to think of when we think about the strength of an archer. Where are we at with the Lord? Again, I could spend a long time talking about, and going into this subject is something that's easier to talk about because it's about building our spiritual strength and living after the Spirit, not after the flesh, and overcoming our areas of sin in our life that allows Satan to come in. There's so much that can be said on that. I see I'm going to run out of time here soon. But the whole focus of that I want the main, if it's nothing else you get out of this topic, is the fact that for the bow and the arrow to be effective, you have to be an archer. We have to be a man and woman of God, or the rest of the stuff is just not going to work. It takes all three to work together. God has given us arrows. I just want to read through Psalms 127 again. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build. Except the Lord keeps the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. Is the Lord building our house? Are we training every day as an archer would to strengthen our spiritual life, to strengthen our spirit, to grow in the spirit, and to push aside the flesh every day? That's what it takes to be a parent. It doesn't take, there's not a checklist of things we have to do for our children. And there can be so many other areas we can mess up in, but if we get this part right, if we're spiritually where we need to be as parents, there's so much that God's going to take care of in the rest of that. It is vain for you to rise up early and to sit up late and eat the bread of sorrow, so he giveth his beloved sleep. Boy, I could just rephrase that. It's vain for you to spend all your time working and be tired all the time and not have time for your family. It's vain. Lo, children are a heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. Children are an inheritance of God. That's what he's given us. He's passed those down to us to pass on to the next generation, to pass on. Are we training our children to be archers? In this account of the longbowmen, the archers started training at 8 years old. They were given bows, or even younger than that. As soon as they could hold them, they were given bows. Our children are the archers of the next generation. Are we preparing them for that? Obviously, this illustration can kind of peter out a little bit in some of these areas, but because our children don't stay arrows, the arrows land and they become archers is kind of the way I look at it. So are we training our children to be archers so they can raise the next generation that way? Or are we training our children to be simply be businessmen or to be whatever? We need to train them to be archers. And heritage is something we passed on. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are the children of his youth. Let's just remember that, forgetting the word arrows, and remember the word mighty man. I think that is the most important part of this chapter. Is it says the arrows in the hand of a mighty man, and happy is the man that has its quiver full, then they shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gate. So that's what all I have on this concept of arrows, and I just want to close this here with a story. It's not quite related to this arrow concept, but it is, I think it ties in very well. And this is for, this can be for each of us. The moral concept of this story is not original with me, but I wrote the story to share in school and in prison. So I'll just read this story, then I think each of us is going to be able to get something out of this that hopefully can be a little bit of an encouragement in our lives. Long ago in a faraway desert land lived a rich, kind man. He lived in a beautiful palace and was known throughout all the land. He had the most beautiful garden that anyone had ever seen. In a land surrounded by a vast desert, people came from far and wide to experience this beautiful garden. In his garden were hundreds of different kinds of flowers that would bloom throughout the year and trees of every kind. There were many wonderful herbs and plants that could be used to heal ailments of every kind. In his garden were the most nourishing and tasty fruits and vegetables that were grown anywhere in the world. As you can tell, people came to his garden to be nourished, healed, and find rest. However, to reap all the benefits of this wonderful garden, the seekers first needed to come to the palace and ask if they could go to the garden. The kind man never said no, and each of the people was required to walk a very long path to the garden. Each and every person who completed the trek down this path always found the healing and fulfillment they were seeking. But to keep this garden beautiful, it required large amounts of water to be carried from a spring by the palace down this long path to where the garden was located. The wise master hired many servants whose job it was to carry water each day from the spring down the long path to the garden. Each servant had a yoke that fit upon his shoulders and a hook on each end so they could carry two buckets of water at a time. Each servant would fill their bucket in the morning, make the long trek to the garden, water the portion of the garden that was assigned to them. They would do this day after day, week after week, and year after year. The servants loved working for their kind, caring master and had much pride and enjoyment in knowing that their labors helped maintain the beautiful garden that could bring so much nourishment, peace, and joy to so many people. One of these servants was Malachi. Each day, Malachi would fill his buckets along with the others and start down the long path to the garden. But each day when Malachi reached the garden, the buckets on his yoke were empty. While the others went to water their sections, they looked scornfully at Malachi and reminded him he was of no value to the garden. You see, the buckets that carried by Malachi each had a hole in it, and try as he might, he was never able to patch these holes. Many times in despair, he would cry to the master for buckets like the others had so he could too help with the garden. The master lovingly encouraged him to continue working, and yet still the buckets leaked. Day after day, week after week, year after year, Malachi carried these same leaky buckets down the path, feeling as if his whole life were a waste. No matter how much he hurried, he could never go down fast enough to bring any water to the garden to be of any use and to make the garden beautiful. The only factor that kept Malachi working day after day was the commitment he made to serve the master. The other servants looked down at poor Malachi and his leaky buckets. The years went by and Malachi became an old man. The master stopped him one morning and took the buckets off his shoulder and led him to the palace. He put his arm around Malachi's powerful, stooped shoulders and told him, "Well done. For all these years you have toiled for me, you've committed your life to my service. Now the time has come for you to be rewarded for your labors. You will spend the rest of your days here with me in the palace. There will be no more labor, no more pain, just enjoyment and luxury for all your days." Malachi fell at the master's feet, weeping, and cried, "I am not worthy of a reward. All these years I have worked, and never, not even once, have I been able to bring any water to the garden. My life has been a waste and a failure. I could not do what the other servants did. I am sorry I let you down." The master gently helped Malachi to his feet and wiped the tears from his eyes and said, "My beloved friend, come with me." He led Malachi up many stairs till they were standing at the pinnacle of the highest tower in the palace. Malachi slowly gazed about the endless desert, and far in the distance he could see the beautiful garden. As he looked over the garden, his eyes followed the path that he had trod for so many days. As he looked at the path, what he saw amazed him. For the entire length of the path, both sides were filled with flowers as beautiful as any in the garden. It was a ribbon of beauty through a vast desert. All these years of walking the path, Malachi had never noticed what was growing on each side of him. Malachi looked at the master and explained, "How can this be? There was no one assigned to water alongside the path." The master said, "Only my most faithful servant was trusted to water the path. Each day as you carried the buckets, the holes you despised are what made the path beautiful. Because of your faithful service, the path is beautiful for anyone who walks down it. This path serves as a guide and motivation for those seeking to reach the garden. You may have thought your life to be a failure because you couldn't do what the others did, but each day I depended on you to water the path. You didn't understand why I didn't patch your buckets, but now you see those holes served a purpose. You obeyed your master and faithfully fulfilled your calling. You, above others, have earned your reward." 1 Corinthians 7, verse 24. "Brethren, let every man wherein he was called, therein abide with God."